Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم dear listeners. Welcome to another program of Islamic Upbringing at IRIB English Radio. This is your host Mehdi with another program we've been talking about for the last few episodes on this question. And the question is, how do you deal with boredom at home when children don't have anything to do and they roam around the house all day? So we've mentioned quite a lot of things and we've been with Brother Miqdad on this topic, so we're going to welcome him to another program. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad, and welcome to Islamic Upbringing.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
So as you know, we mentioned and we discussed, analyzed a lot of things, particularly we mentioned involving the child in daily chores, DIY work, that leads to role-playing that the child does for himself. Once you've initiated it, we talked about recycling toys, we talked about not even toys, the other things that you've got stored up in the house, wherever it is, and you gather around, talk about those things and you know, or memories or stuff like that that you reminisce about, and your children get to learn things from that. So we pretty much discussed everything that we do that involves entertainment and things that children like to do. But what do you think about work that the school has given the children, schoolwork for children during the holidays, something that I myself as a child did not like?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So regarding working schoolwork basically during holidays, if the school has given a particular homework or a number of tasks and activities that the child should be doing during the summer holidays, then or during the holidays, that's fine. That has to be done. And then parents can spend some time with their children to and make sure that this happens, basically. However, I would not recommend parents to be spending a lot of time with their children and teaching their children things that they'll be learning at school in any case. Sometimes you find parents that they do the entire syllabus of the year in summer, for example, with their children. That I wouldn't recommend this, because obviously what happens is the child will be then quite further ahead and doing the year in the class, already had would be quite bored in class then, because he already knows everything. And it's not summer holidays just exactly for not studying, basically. It's there to relax, to play, to do other things than other studies. However, I'm not saying completely stop any all connection with studies. No, definitely there should be a time of the day, or at least during the week, where you do spend time with the children revising things, strengthening their gaps that they've had at school. Don't completely cut off from
academia,
from academia and education, because then it's difficult to get back into it. So reading and maths and these kind of things should be carrying on, but to a very very limited amount. Children shouldn't face and start hating school and feel like, you know what, it's even taking up our lives even during holidays. No. Perhaps even in different forms and shapes, you can try and keep in touch with them, keep them in touch with their education. But definitely not doing things that they're going to do in the future, and not speeding up things that they will be learning later on. You want to mainly just revise, strengthen, keep in touch basically with what they've learned.
At times schools themselves, they do give some... most of the times, I think they've got summer work, holiday homework.
Exactly, that, yeah. So those are things just to keep them up, basically. So do them, but to that necessary amount only, not to do more than what is required.
So it's better, as you said, if I'm not mistaken, to just revise what they've studied in the previous year or term, and that's pretty much it for those holidays. We'll return after a short break and we carry on about this. If there's other things that we need to add, we'll carry on with that. Also, please stay tuned, dear listeners. We'll be back after a short break.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back to Islamic Upbringing, brothers and sisters. We're talking about something that is very boring for children, of course, which is schoolwork. It's not necessarily boring if we put it out the correct way, which is why we're here and talking about it with Brother Muftat.
So, not doing schoolwork is one thing, but one thing I would really emphasize a lot for the summer holidays is skill learning. So, holidays are a very amazing opportunity for teaching children new skills. To be honest, even adults. I would strongly encourage parents to get their children into learning new skills, whether it's knitting, arts, computer programming, coding. There's a huge list out there of skills that children can learn at various different ages, and you'll realize that it's one of the best ways to keep a child busy during the holidays, in a very efficient and very beneficial way. Basically, that they're at the same time learning new things, the same time building their confidence, because skill has a very strong impact on the confidence, because it allows them to do things, they see result, they see product, they feel confident about what they can do. It increases their abilities, and obviously it's usually good fun. Pick a skill that they enjoy, pick a skill that they would appreciate and value. Nowadays you have a lot of emphasis on computer skills, so if you go online, for example, you'll have a lot of courses and apps and softwares and sites that teach children about coding, for example, programming or video editing or making PowerPoints, for example, or making even animations, and all these kind of computer skills, basically.
Yeah, which is something new for that child.
It's new for a child. It's fun. They see result. They see product. I really strongly recommend children to do this. And especially if it's well guided by parents, where parents actually guide them through it and teach them to actually produce Islamic content, for example, or to learn new things and put what they learn into this skill, and it'll be very useful. So even for example, if it's to do with arts, so drawing, painting, pottery, all these kind of things, basically, again, you can put a lot of things that you've learned, the verses that you've learned, the stories that you've learned, the concepts that you've learned, you can put them into the world of arts.
That's an interesting example, that the child heard the story of Prophet Noah, and you tell the child, oh, let's make a boat, for example.
Exactly.
And he's so involved with the story, and he's now physically putting it out in the form of art. We carry on about this after this short break. If you guys, dear listeners, stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, No father has granted a gift to his child better than good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back to Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about summer holidays and what children can do besides the schoolwork that they do. So we mentioned how children can improve their skills and how we can help as parents. And actually, that's something in that's most useful in the practical life also, isn't it? Because when they grow up, we see people complaining, oh, the school never taught us that. Well, that's the time to teach things.
Exactly, yeah. So life skills are very, very important. So this leads us to the next point. You'll find that maybe in your neighborhood, maybe in your community, there's a lot of these groups and these youth groups where they teach life skills, basically, where it's going on an adventure, camping, making fires, and this kind of thing. These are very important as well, if you can get your children involved in that as well. Another one is sports, new sports. So most likely throughout the year at school, they've been playing football and, I don't know,
badminton
rugby or rugby and these kind of things. But summer is the time to start playing new sports. It could be gymnastics, it could be martial arts, it could be wall climbing, it could be canoeing, for example. These kind of new sports out there, they're fun, they're physical, they teach new skills. So sports, exploring these new things are also very useful. So in summary, learning skills, I highly recommend during the summer, getting involved in new sports, putting together what we've learned, producing things. Children like to see that they can actually be of benefit to others as well. So if you do involve them in arts, if you do involve them into new skills, then make sure that there is a product out from that. Share that product. Make them feel that they have an impact on others as well through what they've learned. Increase their reach their skills as well, so they can learn more. They feel thirsty to learn more so that they can produce more.
For example, tell the child to go see what an ant does every day, so that child, that one day is gone because the child is following an ant for the entire day.
For example. So these clever ways to incorporate everything at the same time. So there's a lot of learning, there's a lot of skill gaining, there's a lot of physical things, there's social as well, it's creative. If you manage to put everything together, then it's very beneficial. And all of this requires parents to be a bit more involved, a bit more active rather than passive. A bit more effort, inshallah, and it can go a long way.
Thank you so much. I think there's not much to add. I think there's nothing to add to the question that we had, right? Because we pretty much covered everything you did, to be precise. If there's anything else that our listeners want to add or they'd want to know, they could ask away at englishradio@irib.ir. That's our email. If you've missed out on the previous episodes and you want to listen, you can check out at parstoday.com, parstoday.com. And from me, your host Mehdi, and brother Miqdad, until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returns upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
around the world with reporters.
I'm Mark Wadsworth. You might have heard.
Mark Wadsworth is a lifelong anti-racist who came to prominence during the brutal racist murder of black teenager Stephen Lawrence in 1993. Mark supported Stephen's parents in their long fight for justice and even introduced them to anti-apartheid revolutionary figures Bishop Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela. Yet despite Wadsworth's anti-racial credentials, even he was not spared from the anti-Semitism witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn's allies and pro-Palestinian activists in the Labour Party.
I couldn't believe that somebody, you know, groups of people would try to fabricate him or character assassinate him with all his contributions.
Mark has done so much for the black community, and he has the black community backing him all the way, and to see such libelous statements being made about him it's very disappointing.
Mark Wadsworth was one of many left-wing pro-Palestinian activists expelled from the Labour Party during Jeremy Corbyn's leadership following an unfounded accusation of anti-Semitism. Since then, he's been smeared by a host of British tabloids, including the Jewish Chronicle, who today have been obliged to apologise in open court as well as pay substantial damages. The Jewish Chronicle also published an apology to Mark back in May for an article published in March that accused him of conspiracy to, quote, intimidate, threaten or harass Jewish activists. Accusations that they have now admitted were wholly false.
I'm elated. I've been vindicated. I've suffered 5 years of smear, trial by media. In fact, with the Jewish Chronicle, I managed to get them to change 15 stories. Over a period of less than 5 years, they have had almost 50 articles naming me in a negative way, which is like a vendetta. And I just decided this has got to stop. It's the Labour Party that has done this to me, because by kicking me out on totally false grounds, huge miscarriage of justice, in April 2018, they made it open season.
The judge in the British High Court described accuracy and truth as fundamental tenets of journalism and explained that the allegations made by the Jewish Chronicle with regards to Mark Wadsworth fell short of both. The lies told by the Chronicle were one of many by British tabloid press, but Wadsworth hopes his legal victory will act as a deterrent for those that seek to smear him in the future. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Let the bodies pile on high in their thousands. A sentence seared into the memories of Britons, allegedly uttered by the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson as he reluctantly approved the second England-wide lockdown late last year. Faced with fury from relatives of the bereaved, Johnson and his senior ministers emphatically denied the allegation. The man who made that claim, his former top aide turned nemesis, Dominic Cummings, back with more.
This is terrible, but the people who are dying are essentially all over 80. And we can't kill the economy just because of people dying over 80.
Speaking to the British public broadcaster, he also questioned his former boss's fitness for his role and rebuked the government's pandemic performance. Just like that time, the government denies the allegations, saying the Prime Minister has taken the necessary action to protect lives and livelihoods, guided by the best scientific advice. But the numbers speak otherwise. England had one of the worst per capita deaths among the world's major economies last year, blamed by many on lockdown dithering by the government.
It was even more than that. It was an ideological predisposition towards laissez-faire capitalism and not caring about the fate of the poor. And that's deeply entrenched. They thought, let it spread through the population. Yes, the old will die, but they could use that crisis actually to generate pressure to further pursue the policies they're pursuing anyway, which are not protecting the NHS.
The new allegations come only days after Number 10 made England the first country to lift almost all COVID-related restrictions, despite the rising number of cases, mostly of the Delta variant.
If you look at this Tory cabinet, they look like people who are totally unfitted for office because they simply don't care about the lives and quality of lives of the vast majority of the working people of Britain. That's not their remit. They're there to big business. They've shown that time and again. The fact of Cummings and Johnson falling out is just once again shedding light on what they would really like to bury, and no doubt they will try and bury when they're forced to have a COVID inquiry.
A public inquiry into the government's pandemic response is yet to happen, and it remains to be seen if these latest revelations from the Prime Minister's former advisor will seriously puncture his opinion poll rates or lead to pressure from members of his own party for him to step down. Saeed Forizam, London.
For thousands of years, the Nile River has meant life to people in a largely arid region. But today, the river is associated with an endless dispute. Ethiopia said on Monday that it had attained its second-year target for filling a mega-dam on the Blue Nile, the Nile River's main tributary. The country said the plant may start generating power in the next few months.
We are now putting the turbines of what we call Unit 10. As soon as some important works are completed in a few months, it's all about connecting it to the transformers. And this will provide the biggest outcome of this work for the people of Ethiopia, which is generating electric power.
The project, called the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, has been at the center of a regional dispute since Ethiopia broke ground on the project in 2011. Egypt, a dry land home to nearly 100 million people, depends on the Nile for 97% of its water supply. And Sudan views the dam as a threat to its own dams and water stations, but Ethiopia deems the project essential for its development. A decade of negotiations under the auspices of the African Union has failed to result in a deal on the dam's filling and operations. The UN Security Council met earlier this month to discuss the project, but Ethiopia later slammed the session as an unhelpful distraction from the AU-led process. Experts say foreign powers' intervention throughout the years has only aggravated tensions in the region, and that an African approach to the problem is needed.
I think the problem is the intervention of the imperialist countries, particularly the United States, at this stage. So what has to happen is a more pan-African approach to this problem. Sudan and Egypt should sit down with Ethiopia and negotiate a policy which will benefit all three countries.
Once completed, the $4 billion project will produce more than 5,000 megawatts of electricity, doubling Ethiopia's power output. This is significant for an economy that frequently faces electricity shortages and is sometimes hobbled by power rationing. But Egypt considers the dam as a threat to its existence, and Sudan has warned that millions of lives will be at great risk if Ethiopia unilaterally fills the dam. Is a war between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia brewing on the Nile? The next few months might show if tensions explode into yet another hot conflict in the war-stricken continent.
The cleanup operation continues in Belgium and Germany, the countries worst affected by last week's devastating floods following torrential rainfall. Senior figures from the European Commission have just attended a meeting of EU environment ministers.
50 degrees northwest Canada, 40 degrees in Siberia, 40 degrees in central Europe. The floods you've mentioned, droughts agriculture is dealing with, wildfires.
Last week, the European Commission unveiled plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the 27-nation bloc by 55% over the next 9 years. The Commission claims it's a matter of life and death.
The infernos and hurricanes we have seen over the last few weeks are only a very small window into what our future could look like.
Environmentalists point to what's happening right now. Raging wildfires in parts of the United States and Canada, severe flooding in regions of China, crippling droughts in areas of Iran, recent tornadoes in the Czech Republic. In order to save the planet, campaigners insist the EU must cooperate with big powers like Russia, China and Iran instead of pushing them away.
Official data shows transport accounts for 29% of pollution in the EU, but one large ship generates as much carbon dioxide per day as 80,000 cars.
Of course, the aviation industry is another major player, and so too is agriculture. Experts say the key is to cut our energy consumption and be more efficient.
Therefore, what energy a country uses, what sources, what does it burn? Does it burn coal? Does it burn gas, which about has half the emissions of coal? Or does it do renewables, carbon-free sources? This is tremendously important for climate change.
Environmental groups say the EU needs to move faster and claims the bloc's goals are simply not ambitious enough. They are demanding that leaders agree on decisive action when they meet at a major UN climate change conference scheduled for October in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iranian documentary film Life Among War Flags, which focuses on Afghanistan and the Taliban, directed by Mohsen Islamzadeh and produced by Press TV, has been unveiled in Tehran in the presence of the filmmakers. The documentary movie Life Among War Flags narrates a different story of conflicts between armed groups in Afghanistan. Moreover, it has made research on the role of the Afghan government in such conflicts.
I have been making documentaries for about 17 years now. The Life Among War Flags depicts the story of people whose region is controlled sometimes by the Taliban, sometimes by Daesh, and sometimes by a central Afghan government and the US forces. I believe they are the main victims of the war in Afghanistan. Making this documentary film was very difficult because we had to risk our lives when we went among Taliban forces. We even took part in several Taliban operations to make this documentary film.
One of the special features about this documentary is that they have shown the inner side of the Taliban, which is very dangerous and difficult. Making such a documentary will definitely raise public awareness about the real nature of such groups, which is of course so risky for the filmmakers.
The production of this documentary took 19 months to complete. The documentary's director says it has unveiled a big secret called Taliban and clearly has responded to questions which have for long been formed in the minds of international audiences regarding the nature of the militant group. The documentary film Life Among War Flags takes a deeper look at the lives of Afghan people who have tolerated years of war and bloodshed under different names and have learned to show flexibility to survive. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Poland's Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki and the EU's executive arm, the European Commission, are on a collision course. The Commission is demanding that Warsaw adheres to a recent EU Court of Justice ruling that Poland's disciplinary procedure for judges violates EU law.
We will ask for financial sanctions if Poland does not remedy the situation by the 16th of August. Let me repeat that we have said many times, EU law has primacy over national law.
The Commission has just published its 2021 EU Rule of Law report. It highlights concerns surrounding justice systems and corruption. The Commission says it's examining allegations that EU member Hungary has used spyware to hack into the phones of those criticizing Viktor Orban's government.
We will use all the possible tools to receive more information on this. So, of course, at the internal level with the different services of the Commission, we are starting, you mentioned, investigations. We are starting to collect information.
Other EU countries criticized in the Rule of Law report include Bulgaria, Croatia, and Slovenia. Recently, Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša participated in the annual conference of the MKO terrorist organization, sometimes referred to as the MEK. The terrorist group wants to oust the democratically elected government in Iran. Via Skype, former Portuguese MEP Ana Gomes says that the group is mainly funded by Saudi Arabia and Israel.
MEK pays people to participate in their events. So my question is, how much has Prime Minister Janša been paid by MEK?
Critics say the EU is quick to apply sanctions on foreign nations over alleged rule of law breaches, but is very slow to take action when some of its own 27 member states flout basic standards. The Commission's annual Rule of Law report repeatedly highlights the importance of media freedom. It's ironic because the EU's closest ally, the United States, continues to block .com media outlets operated from Iran, including PressTV.com. However, people can still log on using PressTV.ir. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
There seems to be no end in sight to the tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, the US and some of its Western allies, including the UK, have publicly accused actors affiliated with the Chinese government of hacking Microsoft Exchange, an email platform used by corporations. That has escalated the already tense relations between Washington and Beijing, with the Chinese foreign ministry slamming that's called fabricated allegation.
The U.S. has mustered its allies to carry out unreasonable criticism against China on the issue of cybersecurity. This move is fabricated out of nothing, confuses right and wrong, and is an act of smearing and oppression that's wholly motivated by political purposes. China will never accept.
For years, the U.S. and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. Last week, China was infuriated further after the U.S. administration warned American companies and investors about the increasing risk of operating in Hong Kong. Washington claimed that those companies face multiple threats, including the Chinese government's ability to gain access to data foreign firms store there. The South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The U.K., a major U.S. ally, is also not far behind. London has now announced it would permanently deploy 2 warships to Asian waters. That despite China's constant warning to the U.S. and its allies over their military activities in the region. It seems the U.S. and its allies are concerned about China's growing influence around the globe. That was visible in a recent G7 meeting where the leaders of 7 wealthy nations agreed to counter China's economic and security influences. U.S. President Joe Biden even urged European and Japanese leaders to offer hundreds of billions in loans to developing countries in a direct challenge to Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's global infrastructure development strategy. Beijing's relations with Washington reached the lowest ebb during the administration of President Donald Trump, who waged a tariff war on it. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under Trump's successor Joe Biden, but he has shown no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies toward China. That has helped bring the Asian powerhouse closer to Russia, with both forming an invisible alliance. Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington sees as a threat to its global hegemony.
The village of Vaux-sur-Chevremont on the outskirts of Liège has been devastated. 7 people lost their lives in last week's floods here. Hundreds have been forced to flee their homes.
When the water comes, I see it in my foot. I say, well, okay, we go home. But the water not in my foot come here, and I don't know what to say.
Meteorologists claim 2 months' rain fell here in just 2 days. It's being described as the worst natural disaster for eastern Belgium and western Germany in living memory. However, how natural is it? Climate change is being blamed. Also, there is criticism surrounding planning. Many towns and villages in Europe were constructed on floodplains. Some residents have been told it could be up to 8 months before their homes will be habitable again.
We lost our fridge. We don't even know where he is. He disappeared in the river. Everything is damaged. We have to do everything again.
There was also severe flooding in Netherlands, France and Luxembourg, but there's no doubt Germany and Belgium were hit hardest. Many thousands of homes that were not destroyed are still without electricity, water and gas supplies. It might take weeks before those are restored. Aside from the tragic loss of life, the floods have caused billions of euro worth of damage. Serious questions surround the effectiveness of the EU's flood warning system.
Reviews will now be conducted to find out if all this human suffering could have been avoided.
When we get out of the house was the worst moment, because we have the feeling that we have lost everything and let it there and don't save anything.
The European Commission says it stands ready to provide whatever assistance is required. Throughout Tuesday, flags will be flown at half-mast in Belgium as the country observes a national day of mourning. Jerome Hughes in the village of Vaux-sur-Chèvremont, Belgium.
The morning of Eid al-Adha, Yemenis from all walks of life came together in front of the United Nations office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to call on the international community to redouble efforts to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade imposed on the country.
We are here for the sixth day, demonstrating in front of the United Nations office in Sana'a. The international body has not fulfilled its duty towards the Yemeni people. More than 6 years have passed and we have been subjected to an absurd war that killed thousands of Yemenis. We demand the international community to lift the siege imposed on the Yemeni people and release the oil ships that have already obtained entry permits by the United Nations.
Protesters blasted the United Nations for remaining silent toward the Saudi suffocating siege on Yemen. They called on the international community to take real measures to stop the Saudi piracy against Yemeni oil ships.
We are still protesting in front of the United Nations office, especially on religious occasions, in order to expose to the world the complicity between the United Nations and the Saudi-led coalition, including piracy against Yemeni oil ships despite obtaining UN permits.
Since June 2020, Yemenis have been suffering from a harsh shortage of fuel due to the continued illegal seizure of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia. The fuel crisis has heavily affected the health sector and left the war-torn country in a desperate struggle to survive.
After 6 years of war and blockade, Yemenis say the United Nations has not yet done anything to stop Saudi actions against their country. They accuse the international body of providing political cover for Riyadh's violations of international law. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
The limelight. A scientist advising the British government has accused ministers of allowing infections to rip through the younger population in an effort to bolster levels of immunity before the NHS faces winter pressures. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Ian Sample and Heather Stewart. The piece is titled sage advisor claims ministers trying to get as many as possible infected with COVID. Scientists advising the British government has accused ministers of allowing infections to rip through the younger population in an effort to bolster levels of immunity before the National Health Service faces winter pressures. The allegation comes after England's remaining COVID restrictions were eased on Monday, 19th of July, with nightclubs throwing open their doors for the first time in the pandemic and all rules on social distancing and wearing face masks dropped even as infections run high. Ministers were made aware of scientists' concerns about reopening nightclubs and other crowded, close-contact and poorly ventilated venues without testing or other checks in place. On Monday, 19th of July, Boris Johnson made the surprise announcement that COVID passports will be required for such settings, but not until the end of September, in 2 months' time. What we are seeing is a decision by the government to get as many people infected as possible, as quickly as possible, while using rhetoric about caution as a way of putting the blame on the public for the consequences, said Professor Robert West, a health psychologist at University College London, who participates in SAGE's Behavioural Science subgroup. It looks like the government judges that the damage to health and healthcare services will be worth the political capital it will gain from this approach, Professor Robert West said, adding that ministers appear to believe the strategy is now sustainable, unlike last year, because of the vaccine rollout. A large wave of infections coupled with mass vaccination would push the United Kingdom closer to herd immunity, where enough people in the population are resistant to the coronavirus that it no longer spreads. The threshold for herd immunity with the Delta variant of the coronavirus is unclear, but scientists estimate that the transmission would need to be blocked in about 85% of the population. Ministers have repeatedly denied that achieving herd immunity by letting cases rise is the government's goal. Last Monday's easing of restrictions moved social distancing, the work-from-home order, and legal requirements around wearing face masks through ministers, though ministers called on the public to remain cautious. The move prompted a flurry of regional mandates to maintain face masks on public transport, including on the London Underground buses and trains and Manchester Metrolink trams. Legal limits on mixing indoors lifted at the same time, allowing all businesses to reopen. The change in rules led some clubs to open at midnight on Sunday, 18th of July, leading to packed dance floors across England. Similar scenes in the Netherlands in recent weeks led the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte to reimpose curbs on restaurants and nightclubs as new cases rose sevenfold. Meanwhile, the Shadow Health Secretary John Ashworth said abandoning all precaution and allowing infections to climb not only risks further restrictions in the future, it condemns thousands to long-term illness and places huge pressure on the National Health Service. Rising COVID admissions are helping exacerbate a summer NHS crisis, with operations cancelled and increasing waiting times. It means we're heading into another difficult winter, and high levels of coronavirus circulating could see a vaccine-evading variant emerge. This is an utterly reckless strategy from Boris Johnson. Data from the Office for National Statistics show that the coronavirus in England is now largely an infection among young adults. Cases in the 11 to 16-year-olds are nearly four times more common, and in 16 to 24-year-olds, nearly six times more common than in 50 to 69-year-olds. While generally at low risk from the disease, young people can still develop long COVID and help fuel the epidemic, which drives up cases in those who are more vulnerable. Professor John Drury, a social psychologist at the University of Sussex, is concerned about the changes that came into force on Monday, 19th of July, such as dropping the mandate on wearing face masks, which sent a very strong signal that the COVID crisis is now less serious. Speaking in a personal capacity, Professor John Drury, who participates in meetings of the SAGE Behavioural Science Subgroup, said recent research showed that people use government policy to make judgments on risk and how to behave. The overall message is that the actions by the public, not only wearing face masks but also distancing and avoiding crowded places, are no longer required. This has already affected public behaviour, he said, though those ditching COVID precautions appear to be a large minority rather than the majority. Fortunately, many people are aware of the rocketing infection rates and the risk posed to many people in society, including the most vulnerable, and are continuing to wear face masks and keep their distance out of solidarity as much as self-protection. A government spokesperson said, "Herd immunity has never been part of our pandemic strategy. Our approach has always been to protect the National Health Service and social care, save lives and ensure as many people as possible are vaccinated as we learn to live with COVID-19. While the vaccination program has substantially weakened the link between infection and serious illness or death, we have been clear about the need to exercise personal caution as we ease restrictions. We are encouraging settings to make use of the National Health Service COVID pass by requiring either proof of full vaccination or a negative test, and we reserve the right to mandate certification if necessary to reduce transmission."
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, salam and so welcome to your program, Lantern. We have another special story for today. Let's listen to it. Happiness is based on your perspective. There were two men who'd been bricklayers for more than 30 years. They were working on a huge skyscraper downtown. One man was always negative, discouraged, constantly complaining, and dreaded going to work. The other man was just the opposite. He was excited to show up each day and had an attitude of faith and enthusiasm about life. One day a friend came by the job site and asked them separately what they were doing. The first said, "We're just laying brick. We've been doing this for 30 years. It's so boring, one brick on top of the other." Then the friend asked the second bricklayer. He just lit up. "Why, we're building a magnificent skyscraper," he said. "This structure will stand tall for generations to come. I'm just excited that I could be a part of it. Each bricklayer's happiness or lack of it was based on his perspective. You can be laying brick or you can be building a beautiful skyscraper. The choice is up to you. You can go to work each day and just punch it on the clock and dread being there and do as little as possible. Or you can show up with enthusiasm and give it your best, knowing that you're making the world a better place.
In this episode, we are going to talk about the elements and causes of felicity and happiness in Islam. As we know, happiness may have various manifestations, and one of manifestations of happiness, is felicity. Happiness may entail, being provided with whatever one may desire both in this world and in the world hereafter. However, felicity has a greater semantic spectrum in terms of the point that some people may not be financially prosperous, yet morally or religiously or from the point of religious piety, they may be felicitous people. But all in all, we may say that, for example, the semantic hardcore can be expressed as happiness. In Islam, we find that there are various ways for reaching happiness. We find that in all belief systems, we find that felicity has been defined, in all religion, moral traditions. However, we find that in terms of even materialistic schools of thought, we find that happiness in this worldly life has been defined as being content with whatever one may desire to have been provided with in this world, in this way. At the same time, we find that felicity in all schools of thought is just a relative term, okay? It's relative in terms of receiving any kind of pleasure, absolute pleasure, whether for a long time or for a short time. And at the same time, we find that, for example, those people who are addicted to drugs, okay, when they use the drugs, well, at first instance, okay, they take pleasure. At the same time, we find that nobody would say that, for example, a person who is addicted to drugs should be a felicitous person. No, at the moment of using the drugs, or at the moment of smoking a cigarette, a person may experience a pleasurable feeling, but it never means that this person has reached the status of felicity. So we find that felicity is, semantically speaking, much wider than happiness or just being free. Just being pleased with whatever one may experience or reach. Now we find that one scholar produced a book in which he quoted around, 290 definitions of happiness, and all of those definitions were taken from the books of great men of knowledge and scholarship, or for example leading philosophers and so on. Yet we find that the definitions or the I mean, the ways or modes of reaching pleasure, though they are apparently different from each other, the concentration is on happiness in this world, not on the world hereafter. From this we find that, from this point on, we find that in Islam, there are two concepts or two perspectives. One is concerned with happiness in this world and felicity in the world hereafter. Okay? In terms of happiness in this world, for example, you find that, for example, a king may be regarded, any typical king, may be regarded as a happy person. He may wish, he may have at his disposal whatever he may desire at any time, for example. Okay, just to give a rough example. However, we can't say that. I mean, this king who has been provided with whatever he might wish at this time, in his worldly life, would be regarded as a felicitous person. Why? Because felicity finds expression not in this world, really, but in fact in the world hereafter. Okay, in the world when everybody would be provided with the fruits or with the effects of whatever he or she has done in this way, in this world. So we find that both happiness and felicity may have some overlapping definitions or overlapping aspects or shades of meaning. However, happiness is mostly, the term happiness is mostly applied in the sense of this worldly life, while felicity is used when the fate of any person in the world hereafter is reckoned or is considered. We hope to have taken very important lessons from these observations. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.